This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 25th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're taking a look at a few issues that developed. First, we're going to take a look at a Supreme Court decision on a state law issue, which has some implications, and it was a state that attempted to provide a benefit to law enforcement retirees of their state. Got slapped down unanimously by the U.S. Supreme Court because it didn't provide a similar benefit to federal law enforcement retirees. We have a second rule that looked at a recent IRS technical advice memorandum that decided that the existence of meal delivery services may impact whether employers are going to be able to claim that meals they provide for employees are for the convenience of the employer and exclude them from W-2s. The IRS acquiesced in a case we discussed earlier regarding a hockey team and meals, and we'll talk about how maybe that's not such a big deal at this point, but still we have an acquiescence. We have a discussion that comes up from an article that appeared on Politico's morning tax report that pointed out a loophole that may exist for owners of co-op units that may get around the $10,000 limitation on deducting personal income or personal income and real estate taxes. We'll talk about how Congress kind of forgot to make some links they should have and how that may open it up for those people. And finally, I'm going to have a little discussion about looking at options beyond the safe harbor for rentals under Section 199 Cap A. I've discovered in online discussion groups a lot of confusion regarding, you know, what it means if your rental can't meet the 199 Cap A exclusion. And specifically, there's a really good question posed on New Jersey's Connect site that asked about the issue of a triple net lease and whether or not a triple net lease situation in the right circumstances could qualify as a trade or business. So I'm going to pick that up and go with it along with the question of the safe harbor, and hopefully we have a little better understanding about how 199 Cap A, the safe harbor, and all of this works together. Well, you know, we're still going through tax season, and now it's actually becoming the time when the clock just keeps moving quicker and quicker, and we keep having all these neat issues as clients bring stuff in. Hopefully you're all getting up to speed right now, and you know, you're processing this, and you know, some of you probably are going to be listening to this while doing tax returns. That's kind of an interesting way to go about it, but hey, you know, or your commute, right? You do leave the office sometime, supposedly. So hopefully you're keeping up to speed. And we'll talk about what actually went on this week. Hopefully give you some information in the next half hour that you can kind of find useful. First, let's talk about the case of Dawson versus Steger, case number 17-419, came out of the U.S. Supreme Court this week on February the 20th. This particular case comes out of the state of West Virginia. And in West Virginia, provided that state law enforcement retirees were able to exclude that income from their West Virginia state income tax return. But the state did not provide a similar benefit to any federal retirees. Now, some of you may remember back in 1989, those of you that have been around for a little while, that we had a decision, Davis versus Michigan Department of Treasury, that caused a lot of issues with many states around the country, because prior to the Davis case, a lot of states had a rule that people who are paid out of their retirement programs were able to exclude that from their income, but they didn't offer any sort of similar benefit to federal retirees. Federal retirees complained that this violated basically Title IV United States Code Section 111A, which generally provides that the states are not allowed to discriminate against individuals based on their employment, you know, if between federal and state employees. In essence, they can tax federal employees so long as they do not discriminate in terms of taxing federal employees differently than state employees. In the Davis case, of course, the state of Michigan's view was, well, these are retired employees, so that's not really covered by 111. The Supreme Court in the Davis case, which was decided back in 1989, said, nope, retirees are covered by this. Now, what was interesting in this case is, so Davis was all retirees. What the state of West Virginia did was limited this to only law enforcement employees in the state of West Virginia. So rather than being all state retirees in West Virginia, it was simply those that worked in law enforcement. Now, a U.S. Marshal sued the state of West Virginia, you know, attempted to get a refund by claiming that he shouldn't have to pay tax on his federal retirement income as a law enforcement person. The state of West Virginia said no. The trial court in West Virginia ruled that the state could not do this, that the state had to, you know, give him the same breaks that they gave their own retirees. However, the West Virginia Supreme Court overruled the state, overruled, I should say, the lower court, and they held that, well, no, this is okay because it's only a small group. We didn't really discriminate against a whole bunch of people. You know, it's not really that many. It's a limited group. What the federal people did is really somewhat different than what the state law enforcement people did. Our pensions aren't as generous as the federal. And for all of these reasons, we should be allowed to have this particular exclusion that is tailored just to law enforcement personnel in the state of West Virginia. Well, as you might guess, Mr. Dawson did not like that particular decision. Mr. Dawson appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take on the case, and in a 9-0 decision, this is unanimous decision, the court found that this was in violation of that same provision that caused the problem in the Davis case, that this was an impermissible violation because it discriminated against the federal employees. The opinion of the court, unanimous opinion, was written by Justice Neil Gorsuch. And effectively, you know, what he does is he walks through every one of the state's arguments about why, you know, why Section 111 doesn't apply to the state is different in this case. First thing which he said is, you know, we don't buy this idea that there's significantly different work as to what the U.S. Marshal did as to what at least some of the West Virginia employees who qualify for the law enforcement pension are doing. In essence, there's no significant difference. The only real test West Virginia made was that these people were in law enforcement. So Justice Gorsuch says, yes, you could limit it just to law enforcement. But what you have to do is you have to offer that same benefit to federal employees who were similarly situated. So they would have to offer this to federal law enforcement employees. They couldn't just limit it to, you know, being West Virginia law enforcement employees. The state said, well, okay, maybe it discriminates against some people, but it's not really a whole lot. And so really it's de minimis. We shouldn't have to worry about it. Justice Gorsuch made it very clear that the numbers aren't really what matter here. You cannot discriminate. Not discriminate says not discriminates. If you discriminate at all in your program, you have to basically, if you discriminate at all, the program is in violation of 4 USC 111. And because of that, you know, it doesn't stand. Sorry, it doesn't work. He also said this justification that, well, the state paid lower pensions. He said, well, no. Here's the problem. Nothing in your rule said that we give it to retirees who are receiving a pension less than X dollars per month. You know, there's no economic requirement. You know, the highest paid pensioner in West Virginia qualifies for this pension. Just as, you know, and the lowest paid pensioner from the feds can't qualify for this pension. So you can't imply that, well, generally West Virginia pensioners get less than federal pensioners is not a legitimate reason to tax them differently. And so he said, sorry, you can't get around discrimination going that way. So for that reason, the court unanimously overturned the decision of the West Virginia Supreme Court. This probably isn't surprising. You know, and the fact it was unanimous also makes it clear it didn't really seem to be that obvious of a reason why this should be different than the Davis case. But states like to try these sorts of things. And obviously, oh, by the way, and they also said, you know, West Virginia claimed we had no bad faith. And Justice Gorsuch says, well, I'm going to grant in every case that we're doing this to provide a benefit to these law enforcement personnel locally. He said, but that's not really the issue. 4 USC 111 does not say you can discriminate as long as you don't have bad intent in doing it. Rather, it says you can't discriminate, regardless of your intent. So for this reason, we knocked this one down. As I said, not terribly surprising. We'll see if the states continue to try something here. I'm sure every so often a legislator will come up with an idea like this, and we may see another similar thing. But at this point, the states probably should be aware that if not going to find a very sympathetic U.S. Supreme Court in terms of trying to find a way to work your way into some special exception to the requirements of the Davis case. Next up, this is kind of an interesting technical advice memorandum. In this case, we have technical advice memorandum 2019-03017. It was issued on February the 15th. This particular advice memorandum deals about the special rules under Section 119. Under Section 119, an employer who provides meals to their employees for the convenience of the employer does not have to report those meals as wages paid to the employees. They don't pay any payroll taxes, and the employees do not have to pick those amounts up as income. Now, a key issue here is it's got to be for the convenience of the employer and not the employee. So you can't just provide meals to all your employees just because, hey, that'd be an employee benefit. Well, you can, but if you do that, you got to put it in their W-2. In this case, we're not putting it in their W-2. We're taking, you know, we're going to say, no, we're going to pay for meals. Some of the reasons why companies have justified this before that have succeeded is saying, well, you know, the employees need to stay in the office or at their desk, or they only have, let's say, a 30-minute lunch period. And they just couldn't get out, get lunch, and get back within 30 minutes. The Congress specifically blocked the IRS from raising a defense that they could bring meals from home. You know, the Congress said, nope, we're not going to allow that as an option. So basically, the idea was you were protected. If I decide that during, you know, if I have a valid reason why the employees need to be here, and there's a legitimate reason for a 30-minute lunch other than getting them out of the office earlier. So, you know, it's a 30-minute lunch because we want them to be available to handle issues from clients and customers. We want to have a limited time frame. They won't be available, so their lunch period is set to 30 minutes. Let's say that's our reason, or we have emergencies that develop. We have various reasons why they can't be gone that long, that we could then justify paying for their lunch every day, having, you know, getting their lunch for them, paying for lunch every day. However, the IRS now was looking. This is an exam. It's a TAM, so it means an actual exam going on. A request for guidance was sent to the national office. And this request for guidance goes on for over 50 pages. It deals with a lot of issues. But the most interesting issue was the national office said that, you know, in recent expansion of meal delivery services, you know, they've expanded to many cities, many locations. You can call up now. I know from my office, I can access Uber Eats. I can access DoorDash. I can access Grubhub. You know, I can access Postmates. Any of those organizations will go get lunch from numerous restaurants around the area that we have here. And they'll bring them right back to my office door. I never have to leave the office, never have to go anywhere. Well, the IRS says, well, the existence of that means that an employee, even with a restricted shortened lunch hour, you know, let's say only going to have a 30-minute lunch hour, still has an option to bring to get lunch. Lunch is available. So if you now provide it for the employee, you're paying for something that's really a personal expense of the employee. And because of that, it's not for your convenience any longer. It's for the convenience of the employees and as a benefit. So the IRS said that hurts the justification the employees don't have time for a meal. Now, the other justification sometimes used, maybe don't have a really short lunch hour, but there are no restaurants nearby, is their theory. There aren't sufficient restaurants nearby. The IRS even argues in this case, which is kind of interesting, that the mere existence of the Uber Eats or the Postmates or the Grubhub or the Seamless in the area suggests that there have to be a significant number of restaurants nearby because they deliver from, quote, nearby restaurants. That's how the math works. They said, so they should also consider that as evidence that any defense that there just aren't restaurants nearby also falls apart in this scenario. What this suggests, and we've seen a few issues like this now where the IRS has gone and challenged matters more closely on these meals, it certainly appears the IRS is looking at employer-provided meals much more closely, employer-provided food, other types of issues regarding this area, and certainly coming down on it. Seems to be a focus coming out now. So certainly you want to consider carefully, you know, do your clients actually meet the requirements for excluding from the W-2? Now, again, this still will qualify if it doesn't qualify for 119 special rule. You know, whether it qualifies for 119 or not, you still have the 274E exclusion that says that effectively those meals you provide for the employees, you know, if you have food for employees, that's going to be 50% deductible to you. And here's the flip side of it. Interestingly enough, a second exception of 274E says if those meals are included in the employee's W-2s, it's fully deductible. So technically, it appears the employer actually gets a benefit out of losing this issue from income tax standpoints. Of course, they get a negative from payroll tax, which may end up being as big a problem, and certainly it's a PR problem for the employees. But certainly the IRS seems interested in this area, and certainly they seem to be taking a more aggressive view, and they're simply saying, you know, you got to pay attention to what's happening out there. We'll see if this goes forward, if the IRS continues to push this, and if somebody finally takes it to court. Next up, we're going to go about a case we talked about earlier. Action on Decision 2019-01 was announced on February the 15th. This is the IRS has conceded in this case now in the Action on Decision. They have conceded that they will accept, you know, basically the decision of the case Jacobs versus Commissioner 148 TC number 14 that was issued back in 2017. Now, what the Jacobs case was, if you don't remember, Jacobs case involved the Boston Bruins hockey team. And the question was, the meals the team provides for them when they're visiting a city, you know, they're all in the hotel, they have meals, you know, they get a big conference room that they rent for this purpose, and they have the hotel cater the meal to very detailed specifications, because of course you don't want the hockey players getting sick, and you want them to be, you know, healthy and with their training regimen. So we have this very detailed meal that's provided. The hockey players eat at that location. Was that considered employer provided meals? Back to our old 119 issue. But more importantly, was it provided in an employer facility? Under the law, prior to Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, if that was true, the hockey team got a full deduction for those meals. The IRS was arguing, nope, they should get only 50% deduction. It was found it was employer-provided meals in the employer eating facility, and therefore they got the deduction. Now, what the IRS announced this time is they have acquiesced in result only. What acquiescence in result only means is they will accept the result of this case in a similar case. But they do not agree with the court's logic in getting to the result. They don't tell us what they don't agree with, but they don't agree. They're saying we're not going to accept the logic, so don't try to argue the logic of this case. So we'll accept these exact facts again. But if the facts change at all, you know, we're going to move off this. So basically, all the NHL teams should be able to get their, you know, refunds. And I would assume the IRS will probably not try to argue that NFL teams, Major League Baseball teams, and NBA teams are somehow different. But, you know, don't try to expand this into something like saying, hey, you know what? You know, like I've got to have these meals on the road because I am a, you know, doing continuing education work, and we do lease space from the hotel, right? And, you know, is that going to qualify? Don't try to expand this case and try to go for a refund on those years, which is, I assume, why the IRS is stating this. The other thing to remember is, and why the IRS probably is going to fight the NHL, the NBA on this one, is it's been made irrelevant by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act law change. Don't forget, right now, for an 18 and 19, these expenses now are back to being 50% deductible only. And eventually down the line in 2025, as I recall the date, they end up being non-deductible in whole. So for as far as the IRS is concerned, this has no relevance going forward. And they're really not going to fight that hard on the old cases. But it is interesting to see, you know, that they did give it. And if you do happen to be an NBA team or an NFL team or work with one that hasn't yet filed the refund claim, you might want to file it, because apparently the IRS thinks it's okay to go ahead and do it. Okay, now let's go to a couple of quirks. First, let's go to a real interesting quirk in the law that was actually, it's in the Blue Book. I'd seen it in the Blue Book. But it got coverage in not really the, well, it's tough to say what Politico Morning Tax is. If you're not aware, Politico, we should all be aware, is a website that, you know, that publishes political stories, and okay, fine. But they also run a professional edition. Now, what Pro does is, if you pay them significant money, as I recall, it's one of those things, as I recall, if you have to ask the price, you can't afford to pay it. But what they'll do, they provide detailed coverage of what's going on, like inside Congress, inside the agencies, in very specific areas. And they send out these newsletters every morning that you can sign up for free. And yes, there's no question, these newsletters are meant to some extent to convince you to go get and pay for Politico Pro, which, as we say, not cheap, but it's used by people who need, who really know the detailed inside information going on in agencies, et cetera, and at the, in congressional committees. And they'll tell you these things. And obviously what the morning, what Morning Tax does, sometimes it links the stories in other places, which is no problem. You can read those. But obviously every so often it links to a story that you can only get Politico Pro. So by clicking it, you automatically get this notice saying, hey, you know, you want to subscribe to Politico Pro. This is one of those stories that they reported in Pro. And no, I don't subscribe to Pro, but they gave us enough information that we know where it's going. So in the Morning Tax report that came out on the 21st of February, they noted that they had a story on the Pro side that talked about an issue with the $10,000 cap on taxes on Schedule A, specifically as it relates to owners of units in a cooperative. Cooperatives are, if you're not familiar with the structure, a housing cooperative is in most cases similar to or kind of an alternative structure to a condominium. In Arizona and in most states, basically you're going to find that there are provisions in your codes that deal with, you know, governance of condominiums, but there's also going to be another segment that deals with governance of these things called co-ops. The key differences, let's take the difference between a simple co-op, and by the way, a co-op does not have to be just, it can actually be individual houses too, could be in a co-op, but let's talk about the housing co-ops the way we see the most often, which is like a single high-rise building. You know, that's kind of the structure we see most often in co-ops. In a condo, I own my unit. The common areas are owned by something called a homeowners association, right? So there's a common area ownership by an HOA. The HOA board governs the common areas. They also rule on some of the covenants and agreements we've made, you know, as part of our condominium agreement, our agreement to be part of the condos, the restrictions that we have. So they rule on those, but they don't really own the unit. The unit is owned entirely, literally owned by the person occupying it. So I have a condo unit, I own that space, and I own an undivided interest in the common areas. A co-op is structured differently. In a cooperative, every single unit is owned by a corporation, which is treated as the housing cooperative. The shareholders of the housing cooperative, for their share of stock, they obtain the exclusive right to occupy a particular unit. They don't technically own the unit, but they have the exclusive right to use it. Okay. The corporation pays the property taxes on the entire unit. If I'm a condo owner here in Arizona, I pay the taxes on my condo unit. The Maricopa County here would bill me directly. But in a co-op, the county would bill the co-op corporation, and the co-op corporation then would pay the tax. Well, this is where it gets interesting. Obviously, normally, you can't take a deduction for taxes paid by a corporation if you own a share of stock in it. But there's a special set of rules found in Internal Revenue Code 216 that provide that certain payments made to the co-op are going to be looked through. And specifically, 216A1 provides that you get a deduction for the proportionate share of the real estate taxables that were allowed as a deduction to the corporation under Section 164. That basically that are paid related to what you own in the cooperative. Okay. And it just tells you we're going to get a deduction. Never tells us where we get this deduction, but it tells us we get it. Now the IRS put the $10,000 limit. So generally that's always been reported on Schedule A as taxes, right? IRC code section 160, for those who see the slide, it says 162, it should be 164. It gives us a detailed list of items that are subject to the $10,000 limit. But interestingly enough, the reference is all internal to 164. So it tells us all these taxes as specifically enumerated in Section 164A1, which includes property taxes paid on property you own. That's not a trade or business or 212 activity, are part of the 10 grand. But it never references these 216 taxes. The Blue Book, when it was issued in December, said And this term, the first part of the sentence is your key that there may be some problem. It told us it is intended this limitation apply to deductions for amounts paid or accrued to a cooperative housing corporation by a tenant shareholder under Section 216A1 relating to real estate taxes in the same manner as limitation applies to real estate taxes under 164. And that's from page 68 of the Blue Book. However, you'll find there's a footnote right after that reference. If you follow that footnote to the bottom of the page, it tells us a technical correction may be needed to achieve this result. What that really means is, and to be totally honest, I think if you read it, what the conclusion we come to is, the law as they wrote it does not limit these. Now, this could be interesting. Will the IRS believe, will Treasury believe they have the right administratively to fix this? I think if you, it's not as strained a reading as would have had to have been to get the 15-year life for the real estate glitch fixed. But, you know, but it is a bit strained. You could try to argue that, well, yeah, really the cross-reference to 164A real estate taxes really is these, are these 216 taxes. I think that is a strained interpretation without a law change. But of course, Treasury has not really commented on this yet as to whether they believe, you know, that, the language in Section 164 actually applies to these 216 taxes. If they don't apply, it would appear they would be deducted in full. And by the way, those all the taxes that aren't limited under this rule, and there are some that you'll find qualify, go on line 6 of Schedule A. You'll find it actually is a not limited line. It's kind of interesting. Again, we don't know what's going to happen here. The IRS has not said. We have not yet seen the proposed regulations under 164 or any other sort of formal guidance. Our only guidance under 164 was actually guidance under 170, which related to the, you know, the credits, you know, state tax credit issues. We've not seen this yet. So this is interesting. Certainly, now I realize these are much more popular in large cities on the East Coast, New York, et cetera. But in my career, I did have a client here in Phoenix many years ago who owned a unit and a cooperative in Phoenix. So there aren't many in Phoenix, but they do exist. And I assume that's probably true in a lot of other cities around the country where they're not the norm, but they do exist. So be careful, because one of the issues here is your client may not immediately understand the difference between a cooperative and a condominium. So they may just treat it as all the same. If you pay close attention, though, you'll notice the way the taxes are paid, it's going to go to the co-op. If it seems like if they think they're paying their property taxes, the homeowner association, you might want to double check and see if we got a co-op in play, because you may have one. And if you do, we may have an issue. Finally, I want to take a little bit of time here and discuss an issue that's been coming up. And I've seen it on a couple of discussion groups. Now, I'm pulling out a specific question that occurred on the New Jersey Society of CPAs site. Okay. But that particular poster is not one of the people that appears to be as confused about this as many, because the mere fact, you know, you're coming in and saying, well, this got to be a trader business. You know, it doesn't seem like the mere fact it fails this thing should have any issues. But nevertheless, it does. And we're talking about rentals 199 Cap A. And this is, again, related to Notice 2019-07, or not related to it, as we'll get into a description here, that was issued back in January. So what we have here, and if you download my write-up of this, you'll find it's also on the website, we have some facts here in play. So let's take, I modified the facts some, just to give an example. But still, basically, we have an LLC that operates a shopping center that has a number of tenants, right? The leases are all, with all the tenants, are all triple net leases, right? They're all triple net. They pay for the property taxes. They have to repair their particular units in the shopping center. They're responsible for the repairs and maintenance of those units, you know, and they pay the lease, et cetera. So they're all technically triple net leases. However, because the shopping center structure, the manager who's involved with this, one of the managing member of the LLC spends quite a bit of time dealing with it, certainly well over 250 hours a year. He has to do things like collecting the rents, pay the bills, find new tenants, deal with vendors. Lots of times your contracts with the tenants may say that you get some override of their sales based on sales. So he has to go kind of look into that and do whatever kind of verification of that needs to be done to verify those lease numbers are correct, right? He does all these things. He keeps the records. You know, he deals with vendors. He may need to deal with any special events that they're going to want to try to run in the center where all the stores are doing some special deal. So he's got lots of things to do, even though these are all triple net leases. You know, so manager has clearly got lots of time involved. But here's the problem. When you take a look at notice 2019-07, 2019-07 was published and gave us a safe harbor for real estate activities to be considered a trade or business under Section 199 Cap A. But in order to qualify for that safe harbor, we're told we cannot include in that safe harbor any leases that are triple net. Well, every one of these leases in the shopping center is triple net. So by definition, 2019-07 does not appear to apply. Here comes the concern. Does that mean, since these are triple net leases, okay? First question, does it mean that because we cannot use the safe harbor, we're simply out? I have run into some CPAs who seem to be under the impression if you have a rental and you cannot meet the 250-hour requirement of Notice 2019-07, that you cannot get QBI out of that rental no matter what. Okay. The answer to the question, does failing 2019-07 or being barred from using 2019-07 mean that your entity is not a QBI item? And let's accept that we're not doing self-rentals, because we all understand from back to proposed regs and was in the final regs that self-rentals just become TOBs where they are or not. So we're going to say not a self-rental, we cannot use 2019-07 or we fail it. Are we automatically not a trade or business? Answer that clearly no. When you call something a safe harbor, that doesn't mean it's the exclusive test. Now, in some cases, you know, the IRS kind of indicates that, yeah, it really is an exclusive test. But in this case, even Publication 535 makes it clear if you fail the test, you simply have to go to the general test. Okay. So we'd have to do the general test. Now, the next question is, but wait, but triple net leases, we've all thought they were a problem from the beginning of this. And so the next question is, even, you know, ignoring the fact, and I accept the fact that 2019-07 is not the be-all and end-all, and that I could have a trade or business otherwise, but if all my rentals are triple net leases, am I still hung out to dry? And I think the answer there is not necessarily yes. I think triple nets are more difficult to make work, but I don't think, and especially in a case like this, I think that you can still have a trade or business. Let's go back to the actual test. If you want to go back to the real test of what is a 162 trader business, and it is mentioned in the preamble to the proposed regs, it's mentioned in the final regs preamble, as we recall, and it's mentioned in all kinds of articles. You ever look this up? There is a case from 1987 U.S. Supreme Court, Commissioner versus Grotzinger, okay, 480 U.S. 23. That particular case dealt with the issue of what's a trader business. And in that case, the Supreme Court outlined what are the key tests. There are two tests that you have, and really it works into three tests in reality. In essence, the involvement, including that of your agents or directly the members of the LLC, needs to be both continuous and regular. Okay, continuous meaning, you know, that you have a lot of interactions. Regular means that it, you know, it keeps happening. And it has to be for the primary purpose of income or profit is the reason why we're running it. Well, the income or profit side is fine. We'll meet that. And regular. Yeah, you know what? We get checks every month. That's a regular activity. The question becomes continuous. In the case of a single triple net lease, the problem is there's really not continuous activity. What's happening is once a month you get a check. And these days, since we can deposit checks on our phones, it amounts to opening the envelope, getting the check out of the envelope, you know, endorsing the check, and taking a picture of the front and back and depositing in the bank, and you're done. That may take 10 minutes if you're slow. So, you know, that's not really continuous work. That's very, very intermittent work. But in this case, you know, we may have something different. Now, you've heard lots of things about how we have case law about how a triple net lease doesn't qualify, and we do. There are a number of cases. There are cases that have held that triple nets generally don't. We have a revenue ruling also we've discussed that holds that a triple net was not a trade or business. But all of those cases generally looked at an owner holding a single triple net lease. We do have a case from the Seventh Circuit. Now, it's an ERISA case, but it's an ERISA case looking at the issue of whether something was a trade or business, specifically using the cross-reference to the 162 IRC test for trade or business. And that's the case of Central States Pension Fund versus Personnel, Inc., 975 F. 2nd 789 is a 1992 Seventh Circuit case that found specifically a case of an enterprise, you know, an operation that had a lot of triple net leases, but that involved a lot of activity for other stuff, was a trade or business, which, by the way, looks very close to the case we have here. But the key thing to take away from this, because, by the way, your case may not be as close, as may not be as obvious as this one. I think this one, I feel fairly safe saying that that operation of the shopping center is a trade or business, even if the leases with each tenant are triple net. There's just enough other stuff going on that it's not a problem. In essence, he having that many hours involved, the activity of the manager rises to a high enough level. And remember, that doesn't just mean that the member manager gets treated as a trade or business. It means all the members get treated as a trade or business, because the test for whether we have a trade or business is made at the, basically, the RPE, the relevant past rent level. So everybody gets it. But the reality is, when you have a rental that fails the safe harbor test, you have to use professional judgment. You don't just use the safe harbor as a go, no-go. First thing is, there are cases where the IRS is going to come in later and say it was a trade or business. Why? Because you had losses for 5 years, you know, after 87, then you still have this 1231 gain under the final regs. 1231 gains that are taxes, capital gains, are not QBI, but that loss that's released will affect QBI. And if your taxpayer has some flow through income from another business, he or she will overstate their QBI deduction if we don't treat this negative rental income against it. So the IRS will argue for a QBI, for a trade or business. And then secondly, you know, we just have to apply this test. The safe harbor is so extreme that realistically, I don't believe it tells us much of anything. I don't think anybody doubted that a rental that could meet those tests was ever not going to be treated as a trade or business. So be careful. Don't overuse the safe harbor. I know that everybody wants a bright line test that's, quote, simple and easy to apply. Well, sometimes you don't get what you want. And the issue is 162, or one, basically 162 trade business in Grotzinger, the Supreme Court specifically in its decision said, we do not believe there should be a simple bright line test. This always depends on the facts and circumstances, and you need to go check that. So that's where we stand on that. Well, got to remind you, even though there's not been any CPE much going on here, although there's still a few courses coming up, but you want to make sure you apply what you've learned this year. Again, this is application time. For those of you looking for 109 CAPA, I think some state societies still have some courses they're presenting on this, or at least doing some mainly web-based sessions that you might have on it that are, you know, 2 hours, one and a half hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or still maybe a few of those you can find. But we're getting to the point where basically everybody's in tax season, so that's not going to go. So it's time to try it. Be sure to check your state society's website, though, as we get to the end of tax season. Find the courses. You know, we're going to be presenting a number of courses in a number of states, CAP Professional Education, both on ANA and on tax. So take a look at what's going on. We're setting up those times and dates right now. Some states have already published them. So if you want to, I'm sure that's what you want to go to do as soon as you finish up doing returns this week. But if you want to, you can check. Some of the states have things online already, so you can go sign up and look at and plan your year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week of February the 25th, 2019. As always, brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state societies. You can catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we post our articles. We also have posted there the articles we discussed this week. I also remind you, if you go to that site and you go to our weekly video and audio updates, even if you got this from the podcatcher or got it from another site, you can go to our website and you can find there the PDF that has all these articles so you can read about them. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. On Twitter, you can follow me at edzollers. And as always, I want to remind you, I do follow discussions on the Connect sites for Arizona Society, New Jersey Society, and the Minnesota Society. I also take a look at the Tax Pros group on Reddit. That's at reddit.com/r/taxpros is where you find that. And we'll look in also on Cal CPA's Tax Talk. Cal CPA's Tax Talk and the Reddit subreddit are both open to anybody around the country. Our Cal CPA is open to any CPA, EA, or CPA or attorney, get the right titles there. Tax Pros is obviously open to anybody, but basically, if you post there, you need to be a tax professional, or else your post will probably be referred to go over to just, you know, /rtaxes on Reddit. So we have some useful places to like bounce some things around, bounce some questions around. So take a look there. Otherwise, we'll check back in with you next week and try to go over what's going on the coming week in taxes, because yeah, things just keep happening. And until then, take it easy. Don't work too hard. And we'll see you back here a week from now.